Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, this is the Weekly Worldview. It's the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. So glad to have you aboard again here at the Weekly Worldview, joined in studio, as always, by my extremely attractive audio engineer. Do we want to dive right into the dire warning, or do we want to go to Iran? Well, we can start either way. Let's start with the dire warning. A dire warning from Prince Charles, as recorded in the Telegraph newspaper over there in the United Kingdom. They report that Prince Charles is warning the world. Yes, Prince Charles, the Prince of Wales, has warned that natural disasters like Typhoon Haiyan will become more common due to the inability to take the necessary action to tackle climate change. Inability. He's warning us of, well, whose inability? Hasn't he been the proponent of reining in global warming and climate change for, I don't know, 20 years? It seems to me that Prince Charles set for himself a life's mission to tame global warming. That's been his mission. And it's an endeavor, in my opinion, based on a completely useless and extraneous exertion of human effort that in the end will matter not a whit in the annals of human history. And now he acknowledges that he has failed even at that. Prince Charles, perhaps the most pathetic, meaningless life ever lived by anyone. Thank you, Prince Charles. Perhaps you could just go away. Out of the whole lot, I kind of like Prince Harry the most.
Yeah.
He's hiking down to the South Pole or something this week. Went over to Afghanistan, machine gunning Taliban. I kind of like him the best. I hope he comes around and turns out to be a decent fellow. Now, his older brother seems like a decent chap. He's got himself a wife now and had a child, which is very respectable. But Harry just seems, as my extremely attractive audio engineer pointed out just the other day, he seems like a real human being, as opposed to the rest of the freaks in the royal family. All right, Charles, that's the end of you. Thank you very much. Now we go to an email from a devout listener, Russ, the amateur physicist up in Alaska. He's squaring me away on some of my own stupidity that was exposed last week on the air. I always said I'm just an amateur. But here's what Russ, the chief amateur physicist up in Alaska, writes. He says, Doug, considering your question as to how scientists know the patterns which electron particles pass through slits in an object or barrier, they do so by detecting the spots where the electrons land on a surface on the opposite side of the barrier from where the electrons are fired. And yes, they act just like a wave when not observed, and like a bullet when they are. Einstein, considering this fact, joked that the moon doesn't exist if nobody is looking at it. Hey, that's kind of like the joke I made last week. Me and Einstein are right there on the same level. But we have yet to approach the intellect of Russ up in Alaska. So basically, there's a record of where the electrons land. And if nobody's looking, well, they appear to act as a wave. That's what the record indicates. But then if somebody's looking, they appear to act like a bullet. So to me, it seems just an optical illusion that we just haven't figured out yet. And I appreciate Russ pointing out the fact, at least enlightening me, as to how they were able to observe this without observing it. Well, they observed it after the fact. I should have known that those scientists had a way to figure that out. Russ goes on to say, the quack you quoted last week in the story, who said that there is an existence after death, well, Doug, he also said that there are multiple universes. And Doug, I've come to believe that that may be true, as after watching Obama, I'm sure I was born in the wrong one. Not exactly a scientific statement from Russ, but fairly amusing, I must say. I want to thank all my listeners out there, but especially those who contribute to the broadcast and point out where I am wrong. All right. Now do we want to go to Iran? We go to the Washington Post. Dateline Geneva. Iran and six major powers agreed early Sunday on an historic deal that freezes key parts of Iran's nuclear program, yada, 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 yada. Now, the agreement, according to the Washington Post, was signed at 3 a.m. on Sunday morning. I'm not a big believer in deals that are signed at 3 a.m. I have a problem with anything that's signed late, late at night or early, early in the morning. And when we look at this negotiation that took place, there's an easy way to determine who has the upper hand in the negotiations. And that is, whose diplomats scurried at the command of whose. I was involved in negotiations over this past 2 weeks with prospects who I was hoping to convince to purchase products that I represent. And I had one of them call me early in the morning and ask that I meet him within an hour or so, approximately 60 miles away. Well, what did I do? Well, I got my act together and I jumped in the car and I bolted over to his place because he had the upper hand in the negotiation. He was the buyer. I'm just the sales guy. So anyone who had been observing those negotiations would know that he had the upper hand. He was calling the shots. He was doing most of the negotiating. So when we look at Iran and what happened over in Geneva, the Washington Post points out that on Friday, John Kerry flew to Geneva for the second time in 2 weeks. And at the late night negotiations, they report that foreign ministers from the major powers joined lower level negotiators on Saturday. So the Iranian negotiator snapped his fingers, and the world powers fell all over each other trying to make it to the negotiation table on time to cut a deal with Iran. And so the deal, if you can call it that, guarantees peace in our time. I have a document here signed by Mr. Rouhani that ensures peace in our time. Yes, I know. I know it's a fairly well-played analogy between the appeasement of Adolf Hitler and what has taken place in Geneva. They're giving Iran 6 months. It's a six-month trial deal, according to the great world powers and negotiators who scurried to bow at the feet of the Iranian foreign minister. 6 months. And Iran is a month or two away from at least one nuclear weapon. They may already have a nuclear weapon. And so now Barry and Kerry, the Barry and Kerry show, have negotiated a deal that guarantees Iran will have a nuclear bomb within 6 months. And so I still posit the fact that I won. I had all my money in the pool on the fact that Israel would bomb Iran before Thanksgiving. And now we're not to Thanksgiving yet, but I posit that I won. It's just that Israel has been temporarily interrupted from the bombing campaign by Iran's allies in the United States, China, Germany, Russia, and whoever else was there, whoever else was scurrying around. Just disgusting. So Iran has secured their nuclear weapon, and I'm not sure what the Western powers have gotten out of this deal, except the assurance that Iran will indeed be a nuclear power within the six-month trial deal that was so skillfully negotiated by those who bowed and fetched at the command of the Iranian foreign minister. All right. Just embarrassing. It's an embarrassing day to be an American. This is one of those days that I think is a watershed moment in the decline of the West. This is one of those deals that will be remembered down throughout history as one of the great cowardly surrenders that led to the dominance of violence and Islamic fanaticism that may very well engulf the world in 1,000 years of darkness. Speaking of being embarrassed to being an American, let's go to CNN, as if that's not enough. I mean, just the fact that CNN is on the air makes it embarrassing to be an American. But CNN is reporting that North Korea has confirmed that it is holding an American citizen. 85-year-old Merrill Newman of Palo Alto, California, has been detained in North Korea since October 26th. Merrill Newman, 85 years old, is a Korean War veteran. He was on a 10-day organized private tour of North Korea. Now, the first thing you have to ask is why? Why would anyone in their right mind go on a guided tour of North Korea? Well, and the answer is simple. Merrill Newman spent time in North Korea fighting against the North Koreans and the Communist Chinese, and he probably lost a number of his friends there. He's 85 years old, and he wants to go back and revisit that place where in his youth his manhood was forged. An honorable thing to pay tribute to his brothers in arms who were lost before he passes on to his reward. And he's been detained by North Korean authorities. What is the response of the formerly great world power, America? Well, this week, the United States is issuing a warning to American citizens against all travel to North Korea. Yeah, and now John Kerry has called on North Korea to release Americans being held, calling the detentions, quote, very, very disturbing choices by the North Koreans, unquote. Now, we all know that John Kerry is pro-choice. So he says these are disturbing choices by the North Koreans, but implying that they have the right and the ability and the authority to make such choices. In my opinion, he's acknowledging their supremacy over us. He might as well go and bow down before that fat little puke who's running North Korea now, Kim Jong-un. He might as well just bow and scrape in front of him. By the way, Kenneth Bay was arrested in November of 2012, and he was an American citizen, and arrested to sentenced to 15 years of hard labor. I wouldn't be surprised to see a press release come out in which the State Department acknowledges or apologizes that Merrill Newman, who obviously, as a Korean War veteran, probably shot at his fair share of North Koreans, offending their sensibilities at the time. He should have known that his presence there would be offensive to him, and he should not have undertaken such a provocative act as to revisit the place where he once made war upon the friends of the Barry and Kerry show there in North Korea. I'm awaiting that press release as we speak. Ah, yes, that's it. They'll dispatch Dennis Rodman to go play a game of horse with Kim Jong-un to see.
Lose on purpose.
Oh, well, he would have to lose on purpose. And then beg Kim Jong to let the Americans go just out of his beneficence. Finally, from the international scene, ladies and gentlemen, we go to the East China Sea. An extremely important development has occurred. China, this past Saturday, set up an East China, what they're calling an East China Sea Defense Identification Zone that includes the Japanese-held Senkaku Islands. And Saturday, after the announcement, China even scrambled their Air Force jets, including fighter planes, to patrol the new zone. Now, in Tokyo, the head of Japan's foreign ministry lodged a protest by phone with a minister at the Chinese embassy and is quoted as telling his Chinese counterpart that Japan can, quote, never accept the zone set up by China, and branding China's move as very dangerous. The Chinese defense ministry on Saturday said that it hopes all relevant sides would positively cooperate and jointly maintain flying safety. This is all about flying safety. We want to make sure that everything within our zone of influence is very, very safe. This is not about aggression. This is not about China threatening to start World War III. This is really, everyone should know, it's all about safety. Fading out, and I'm coming in. It's the Weekly Worldview. I'm your host, Doug McBurney. And please don't think that just because I do a funny Chinese accent, well, funny, I don't know about that.
Sorry.
What was that? I thought maybe World War III had started. Okay. My extremely attractive audio engineer is allowed to make mistakes.
I'm sorry.
Because of her extreme attractiveness.
Oh, God.
She knows she has job security here no matter what. Now, the accent affected by me in mockery of the Chinese leaders who insist that, well, what they really want to do is just make sure everyone is flying safely over the Senkaku Islands. My affected Chinese accent should in no way be interpreted as disrespect for the Chinese people in general. In fact, I just got the book, which I have to recommend to everyone, called God's Double Agent, written by Bob Fu. A fantastic book. I've read the first three or four chapters. My 12-year-old daughter, Nicole, consumed the first four chapters on the way to and from church. And I have to give a hat tip to Bob Fu, because a lot of these autobiographical accounts of Christian persecution, many of them that I read, while inspirational on a certain level, just aren't necessarily written all that well. And I've got to tell you, from the minute I opened the book, I had a hard time putting it down. It reads like a novel. It's extremely realistic, and it really pulls you in. I recommend the book, God's Double Agent, by Bob Fu. I am working to orchestrate the interview of Bob Fu by Bob Enyart here in the coming weeks. We've just about got it nailed down. His people have been talking to our people, and we are going to make that happen. And I can't recommend the book enough. By the way, I'm arranging the interview. They offered to send me the book, but I bought the book before they had even offered. Before I had even thought about arranging an interview, I bought the book. God's Double Agent by Bob Fu. I can't recommend it enough. Every Christian in America should read this book, and every heathen for that matter. And every Chinese sycophant who views China as the next dominating global force. If you want to know the truth about the depth of evil and wickedness rampant in the Chinese government, well, and I'm just in the just finished three or four chapters. Astonishing. Anyway, I can't wait. I hope that interview comes off. I think it will be quite it'll be the seminal interview, I believe, when Bob Enyart crosses paths with Bob Fu, Lord willing. All right, now let's move on to a story that I followed this past week like a soap opera. It's the story of serial killer Joseph Paul Franklin. Joseph Paul Franklin, according to his own account, murdered 22 people. And he was convicted of a murder that he committed in 1977. And he was still alive when I first started following the story, because the headline indicated that serial killer Joseph Paul Franklin was going to be executed this past Wednesday. And I read the story from CNN, which was, as you can well imagine, a rather sympathetic article toward the murderer, as CNN is wont to do. He says of his childhood, he says, "My mama didn't care about us." And then they give a bit of his life story here, and there's no mention of his father anywhere. So I'm just pointing that out. That's all. Why is he a bastard? Well, because he never knew his father. He found a family and comfort, according to CNN, in the white supremacy groups of the 60s and 70s. At the age of 26, he changed his name to Joseph Paul Franklin. Why, you might ask? Well, Joseph Paul, in honor of Paul Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi minister of propaganda, and Franklin after Benjamin Franklin, oddly enough. Yeah. And he was scheduled to be executed, and CNN asked him, you know, do you think you'll be executed? How do you feel about it? Of course, you know, they wanted to get a sob story out of him, pull on the heartstrings of the anti-death penalty crowd. And now he's most famous, you may all know, for shooting Larry Flint. Yeah, he shot Larry Flint through the spinal cord and put Larry Flint in a wheelchair for life, made him a paraplegic. And, well, Flint had been lobbying this past week for clemency. Larry Flint wanted a stay of execution for the guy who severed his spinal cord. Larry Flint is quoted in the article. He says, "It's much more punishment to put somebody in prison for the rest of their lives than it is to snip their life out in just a few seconds with a lethal injection." And he says he wanted clemency for Franklin on principle, and had been fighting last week to spare the murderer's life. Well, just a note to Larry Flint: it's not much more punishment to put someone in prison for the rest of their life than to snuff out their life and immediately place them in front of the judge of all the earth and the universe, the living God, Jesus Christ, who will render judgment rightly. That's much more punishment than lounging around in prison, getting high, and watching TV for the rest of your life, Mr. Flint. But we wouldn't expect a lot of reasonable commentary from Larry Flint, after all. A man who himself should be arrested, tried, and executed for his crimes against civilization. Now, what does the murderer, Joseph Paul Franklin, what does he have to say about the justice system? He says, "It's just not a system that operates according to the Bible." He says, "The scriptures tell us when someone repents, God forgives them. Everything is forgotten once you're forgiven, but the state just doesn't think that way." He says, "I'm no longer dangerous and I'm no longer a racist. I've cured my mental illness through education. And as of Wednesday," he said he was hoping to get a stay. He says it might not happen, but if a stay does happen, I'm willing to accept the will of the Lord. So, Joseph Paul Franklin, murderer, he doesn't know God. And he probably knows a little bit of the Bible because he spent a lot of time in jail reading the Bible. But he does not know God. He has not repented. And if he thinks a stay of execution is the will of the Lord, well, he doesn't know the Lord. Well, he didn't, as this story went to print. Anyway, he says he won't be burning in hell because he says, I'm serving the Lord. It'll be the kingdom of heaven for me because I've repented. So, he was hoping for a stay. And, well, he's going to get a stay, long stay in hell, as a matter of fact. Now, I was following that story on Wednesday, eagerly anticipating the just execution of a mad dog killer. When this story came up on Wednesday evening, judge grants stay of execution for serial killer Joseph Paul Franklin, and my heart sank. U.S. District Judge Nanette granted a stay of execution, finding that the use of pentobarbital as the execution drug, well, Judge Nanette said that carries a high risk of contamination and possibly prolonged unnecessary pain beyond that which is required to achieve death, said U.S. District Judge Nanette. She said, given the irreversible nature of the death penalty, it's permanent and irremediable, she said. Because of that, it could amount to cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment, said Judge Nanette. So she says that the death penalty is irreversible. So she denies the resurrection of Jesus Christ with that statement right there. And she says that an unjust death penalty, or I guess not even unjust, because nobody doubts the fact that the guy's a murderer. She just thinks the pentobarbital might burn his veins or something. He might get an uncomfortable tingle as he drifts off into the great beyond. And she says, well, we could be doing permanent, irremediable, cruel and unusual harm. And so here's another judge who, number one, she has no concept of Jesus Christ and his ability to right all wrongs. She'll never give him credit for that. She believes that the state is God. And that's what she teaches by her rulings and her judgments. Now, the governor there in Missouri, which is where which was where this bastard is scheduled to be killed, he says the reason that Joseph Paul Franklin should be executed is because he committed merciless acts of violence fueled by hate. Is that your standard, Governor? That the death penalty only be reserved for those who perpetrate merciless acts of violence fueled by hate? What about just merciless acts of violence? What about simple murder, Governor? Is that not enough in your book to warrant the death penalty? Well, it is in God's book. And in God's book, the death penalty should hurt a bit. And it should be public. And the first hands upon the killer should be those against whom he perpetrated his crime. let's see here. Oh, one more from Larry Flint. Larry Flint, who was paralyzed by Franklin's bullet, has called for clemency, saying, quote, the government has no business at all being in the business of killing people. So, yeah, Larry should know, because that's the job of pornographers. That's been Larry's claim to fame for the better part of a generation. The pornographer is in the business of killing people. Mr. Flint, the government should be in the business of securing justice for the victims of all manner of killer, whether a hate-fueled racist on a killing spree or a pornographer who orchestrates the destruction of men, women, children, and families all over the country and all over the world, Mr. Flint. And I cannot wait to be there on that day when you face Jesus Christ and you learn the truth and you receive your just reward. I'm on my way to the promised land.
Oh,
Larry Flint. Wheels up. Wheels and all. On his way. Now, I told you that I had been following the story like a like a soap opera Tuesday and Wednesday. And the final installment was a very brief report that I pulled down from the internet. Joseph Paul Franklin was executed Wednesday morning after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected his final requests for a stay. He was executed at 6:17, bright and early in the morning, so he could go and meet Jesus and discuss his flawed theology just before being sucked over the rim and down into hell. Mr. Franklin. Despite the pleas of Larry Flint, Mr. Franklin was executed. We can only hope that Larry Flint meets a similar end sooner rather than later, and preferably judiciously now, but in a much more painful situation. All right. Now, I'm going to go to National Public Radio. Don't turn it off, folks. I know. You start reading from National Public Radio and you fall into that lullaby voice and listeners fall asleep. People fall asleep at the wheel. National Public Radio is a danger, I believe, just because of the lack of talent of their broadcasters and their ability to put people in danger who are driving on the highway and could not off. But National Public Radio, I pulled this off their website because I don't listen to National Public Radio. You couldn't pay me to listen to National Public Radio. But they had a report about personhood in the womb. And the headline reads, "Personhood in the Womb, : a constitutional question." So first thing right out of the gate, NPR, personhood is not a constitutional question. It's a biological, spiritual, scientific question. It's a moral question. It's a civilizational question. It's not a constitutional question. But Lord willing, at some point in the future, some just government will have personhood addressed in their constitution. But personhood was settled long before any constitution was written. But let's dive into the story here. There was a study, according to NPR, that found 413 criminal and civil cases where law enforcement intervened in the lives of pregnant women between 1973 and 2005. And mostly in the legal claims used to justify some of these actions rely on the same arguments that are made in support of personhood measures that would grant the fetus full constitutional rights independent of the pregnant woman. So most of these cases are junkies and drunks, mothers who are abusing themselves with alcohol and drugs, and by nature also involving their unborn child, abuse of their unborn child through the use of alcohol and drugs. So they report that 413 cases in approximately 40-some years, okay? Now, we have a quote from Lynn Paltrow. She is a representative for National Advocates for Pregnant Women. I had written here National Advocates for Destroying Pregnant Women, but her group is called National Advocates for Pregnant Women. And she says that the Civil Children's Code permits pregnant women who habitually lack self-control in the use of drugs or alcohol to be taken into immediate custody only on reasonable suspicion. And she says, many prosecutors in many states have arrested women based on the claim that they were pregnant and using drugs or alcohol. Now, first of all, Ms. Paltrow, we just learned that there were 413 cases in 40 years. So to say that that's many prosecutors in many states is a bit of a stretch. 10 or so cases per year throughout the entire country? That's many, many? So she's overstating her case right there. So she says that these arrests, these many, 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 many arrests, were made because child abuse laws are interpreted to apply to fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses, and give police officers and others authority over pregnant women. First of all, I just want to point out that she's now broken down the Untermenschen that she just talked, that's the subhumans. She's broken down the subhuman class now into three sub-subclasses, fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses, all three of which are subhuman in the view of the national advocates for destroying pregnant women. And she argues that these laws give police authority over pregnant women. Well, you know that law enforcement has authority to enforce the law over everyone. Men, women, pregnant women, everybody. If you're breaking the law and you're pregnant, you don't get a pass. If you're abusing another person and you're pregnant, you don't get a pass just because you're pregnant. Well, but maybe you do in the view of the national advocates for destroying pregnant women. And now we read this particular baby killer's description of the personhood movement. She says, the personhood movement is working to have fertilized eggs, embryos, fetuses, and fetuses recognized as completely separate constitutional persons under the law. And then she cites the group, Personhood USA, as the primary advocate of such laws. So again, she breaks the subhumans down into embryos, fetuses, and fertilized eggs, just for good measure. Just in case the law needs to be parsed at a later date, she can make sure that, well, maybe we can only kill fertilized eggs, or maybe it's only fetuses. Perhaps embryos will be spared. She makes sure to separate her Untermenschen into different classifications. She goes on, the question that personhood really raises, she says, is, as a society, do we believe that there is a point in pregnancy where women lose their civil rights? How evil and wicked is this woman? And how satanic is the title of her organization, National Advocates for Pregnant Women? The whole focus of her organization is to maintain the legalized murder of women, innocent women. The ones in the womb, the Untermenschen, the subhumans that she mentioned earlier. It's just satanic. Now we move on. Jennifer Mason of Personhood USA enters the picture to get her short shrift from NPR. But even in short shrift, Jennifer Mason, spokesman for Personhood USA, does manage to get in a word edgewise for righteousness and the American ideal and liberty and justice and God, family, and mom, and apple pie, and all of that. Jennifer Mason says, in the personhood movement, we believe that every human being, regardless of their location, whether they're in the womb or out of it, deserves human rights. She says, I think it's appropriate to treat a case just like you would a case where a woman is giving drugs to a newborn at home. Children that are addicted to drugs go through terrible withdrawals. It's abuse. The womb, says Mason, should be the safest place for babies and should not be subject to poison just because they're helpless and located in the womb. Mason, on behalf of Personhood USA, says, I think to give pregnant women a pass just because they're pregnant, when anyone else injecting drugs into a child would be prosecuted, is wrong. Well, who can argue with that? Well, enter Barbara Levy of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, another baby killer, Barbara Levy. She's asked by NPR about the effects on the fetus of women using opioid drugs during pregnancy. And Barbara Levy of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says, well, we know of no long-term consequences. Really? Now, can you think of any other conversation in which an OBGYN or a representation of the largest OBGYN organization in America would say, well, there's no long-term effects? Yeah, when I shoot heroin. Oh, what's that? You're shooting heroin while you're pregnant? Oh, don't worry about that. We don't really know of any long-term effects. Can you imagine that conversation happening in a doctor's office? Woman says, Doc, I'm shooting heroin. I'm struggling with my addiction. You know, I'm 4 months pregnant. What should I do? Well, just keep shooting the heroin. You'll be fine. She says, she goes on to say, the placenta filters a lot of this out. So the amount that gets to the baby is far less than what you're seeing in the mother. Exposure to a very low amount of medication wouldn't have a significant effect long term. It's just silly. And she warns that abruptly discontinuing some of these medications can result in very negative outcomes for the baby. Now, you notice that NPR skillfully crafted the conversation around opioid drugs. Because opioids, although they are massively destructive on society and lives and families and men and women and children, they are the least biologically negative affecting drugs that your average drug user can take. But most women who are junkies these days, they're on crystal meth. I wonder if this lady would say the same thing about cocaine, crack, alcohol, methamphetamine. Would she give the same advice? Well, NPR chose not to discuss that because they had their agenda. And they're fairly smart people. So they crafted the argument around opioids so that this woman, this baby killer, Barbara Levy from the American Congress of OBGYNs, could state her very narrowly focused points. So she says, if you stop the woman from taking her heroin, that can result in negative outcomes for the babies. The babies, she said, have more negative effects than if we allowed proper treatment for the women. And so are you saying, Ms. Levy, that proper treatment would not involve the mother surrendering some of her civil rights? How do you put someone in treatment without violating some of their civil rights? Most people who end up in drug treatment don't start out going there voluntarily. For your information. She goes on to say, what we're doing is we're criminalizing a medical problem. We don't do that to any other segment of our society. What? Are you serious? Are you serious? We sentence drug addicts and drug dealers to rehab and jail time every day. So don't tell me we don't criminalize this medical problem. I mean, how does NPR let her get away with saying this? She goes on to say, I understand the concern for the unborn fetus, but, so that there's always a but with the baby killers. We love children. We love fetuses. We love fertilized eggs. We love embryos. But, she says, the very best outcome for the unborn fetus is to treat the mom and the baby as a unit. Get the best care for the mom, which I'm certain in the mind of Miss Levy often involves butchering, burning, poisoning, shredding, or ripping the baby apart and tearing it out of the mother's womb. That's what she's all about. I understand concern about the unborn fetus, but that's the mantra of the professional child killers. Who have infected the American Congress of obstetricians and gynecologists. Anyway, we appreciate Mrs. Mason's efforts to speak some sense into these mad, rabid killers, to speak truth to power, as it were. But I don't know that she got through to anyone over there at NPR or anyone who was even listening to NPR.
Who's listening?
I don't know who's listening to NPR. It's not me. Now, let's move one more from the personhood file. This is from the in-your-face politics of child-killing file. Planned Parenthood held a ribbon-cutting ceremony on Sunday down in Texas. In Fort Worth, they opened a brand-new abortion clinic located next to an adoption center. Right in your face. Cecile Richards attended the ribbon-cutting ceremony, according to Breitbart. The new $6.5 million facility was privately funded by Texans. And, said Doug McBurney, I'm certain that it meets all the regulations that the pro-life industry has established for the well-regulated murder of innocent people in the formerly great state of Texas. All of you pro-life, quote-unquote, pro-lifers who want to regulate the murder of innocent people, I guarantee you that this Planned Parenthood Killing Center meets all of your requirements. Thank you very much. And you know what? This is really in your face, folks. This shows that there's no need for the wicked to be discreet about their sin anymore. There's just no need. Our own president voted that babies who survive an attempted abortion should be bludgeoned to death on the operating table by the doctor. And he has never recanted that position. Homo perverts are celebrated as the ideal new world man in America. Pornography floods the media. Our government says that Israel is the cause of war and negotiates with a satanic, homicidal, suicidal regime founded by the Nazis in Iran. No need to be discreet about your wickedness anymore. Not in America. It's a monster. Texas is a monster. Monster. Sideway out and play with me. And turn me into a habit. And after that, once you and me, you can't say you get me on me. It's on my mind. Most of the times is when I find the art of life. And it will stop. Yeah, in our hearts, it's gone too far. That's who we are. It's a monster. It's a monster. It's a monster.
And it's the Weekly Worldview.
Thank you for hanging with us as we analyze the culture through the lens of original thought, which is biblical thought, which is the thoughts as recorded by the Creator, the instruction manual for life, in the Holy Scriptures, the Bible. And speaking of that, we go now into the culture file, war file, military file. I didn't know where to file this. Fox News reports that the Air Force Academy has admitted that they have removed the phrase, "So help me God," from three oaths in the latest edition of their official cadet handbook. And Christians are outraged. Small C Christians. They're outraged. Fox News is outraged by this. Oh, yes. In fact, the girl who read the story on the news as she hiked up her skirt and showed off her thigh, she was outraged. You know, your average shallow cultural Christian who just shows up at church for whatever. I don't even know why they go. The average shallow professing Christian, they value more the appearance of religiosity than true religion itself. Because if you read the writings of Paul in the New Testament, he says, don't take any oaths. Don't swear by heaven or by earth or by the temple or its gold. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. So a Christian who understands the nature of God and his desire for us would not be offended by the fact we're offended that they have "so help me God" in the oath. But the appearance of religiosity is what matters most over at Fox News, and the thighs of their female anchors. Those are the two most important issues. Anyway, and now we have another one in the same vein. We go to the politics file from Breitbart. Ken Burns, who is an historian of sorts, filmed all living presidents as well as various Hollywood personalities and luminaries reading the Gettysburg Address. You remember the Gettysburg Address. Of course you do. We heard about it all week. It's the speech that was delivered by Abraham Lincoln 150 years ago this past week. Well, curiously, in Barack Obama's version of the speech, his delivery contained a glaring omission. In a line that every other celebrity delivered, thusly, they said that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom. Well, when President Barry read it, he left out the words "under God." And then the Fox News girl hiked up her skirt and she was outraged. I think Barry is just like Richard Nixon or Bill Clinton. He's a godless liar, a thief. He's a killer of the innocent. But they had to fake it. Bubba carried that big old Bible. And, you know, Nixon would patronize the Christians when it was politically necessary. You had to do that. But not anymore. There's just no need to hide the fact that you're a liar, a thief, and a killer of the innocent anymore. There's no need to be discreet about it. And Barry's just right in your face with it. Yeah, I'm frank. I'm not outraged. I'm not surprised in any way that he left out God. He doesn't know God. What he does know about God, he hates. All right. And now we go from the American version of the war on Christianity, if it can be called that. It's more like it's just a retreat of Christianity. A rear guard action here in America. But now let's go over to Nigeria for the real war on Christians. Not just an academic discussion about persecution. But in Nigeria, according to Jerusalem Post, the Al-Qaeda-linked Islamic group Boko Haram has unleashed a new tactic in its war to obliterate Christianity in northern Nigeria. The new tactic? Convert or die. Two gunmen from... Wait a minute, a new tactic? Isn't that how Mohammed started the religion? He put a sword to your throat and he said, are you going to worship Allah? And they said, yes, we'll worship Allah, whatever you say. I don't know why the Jerusalem Post thinks this is a new tactic. Even in the modern war, the modern long war against Islamic fanatics, it's hardly a new tactic. Anyway, I guess the tentacles of American journalism schools have reached over into Israel and destroyed a generation of journalists there as well. Two gunmen from Boko Haram kidnapped Haja, a 19-year-old Christian, back in July. She was held for nearly a year. She says, if I cried, they beat me. If I spoke, they beat me. They told me I must become a Muslim, but I refused again and again. The Islamists threatened her with a knife pressed to her throat and said her options were to convert to Islam or die. She had watched Boko Haram members slit the throats of other prisoners that were captured and held with her. She was held as a slave. Now, Jerusalem Post reports that Boko Haram is generally translated as Western education is sinful. That's what their name means. And we have a quote here from a professor of religious studies at Rice University. He says, Boko Haram's methods are, quote, part of a pattern you can find in a lot of groups. Salafi, jihadists, for example, like in Syria, unquote. Yeah, you know, Barry's Bandidos over in Syria, the ones we're arming. The very people that the Barry and Kerry show are arming in Syria are the people who put a knife to the throat of Christian women and tell them to convert or die. Now, a spokesman for the United States government, Bureau of Democracy. What is that? We have a Bureau of Democracy? What, did somebody's cousin need a job? Well, this spokesman says, quote, we have seen reports of forced conversions and enslavement. He says, we've seen these reports, and the United States strongly condemns any acts of forced conversion or enslavement, if true. I mean, if it's true. We don't know if it's true. I'm sure this 19-year-old Christian woman obviously had a lot to gain by making up this story of being held as a slave and threatened with death. It's probably all just part of her strategy to publish a book. We don't know if it's true. I mean, that's just what she says. Is that all we have on that? Anyway, that's real persecution. Okay? That's real persecution. Forget about oaths and the war on Christmas. This is where you get a knife to your throat. Well, if it's true, we don't know. She probably made it all up. She wants to get a reality show, I'm sure. All right, now, are you looking for a hero? Are you looking for a hero? Because CNN has crowned their Hero of the Year. Every year they do this. They have a contest. Mm-hmm. And this year, I believe last year, it was the Muslim girl who insisted that women should be educated until the Islamists shot her in the head. And she is now an advocate for oppressed Islamic women all over the world and insisting they should be allowed to learn to read and write. Well, I couldn't fault CNN with that pick. I think that was a courageous young lady after being shot to stand up like that. Well, this year, CNN has outdone themselves. They have crowned an Illinois man who has dedicated his life to cleaning the Mississippi River. They've crowned him the hero of the year. He organizes community cleanups across the country. He has a nonprofit group. And he has collected more than 7 million pounds of trash in the past 15 years. You need a hero, America? There's your hero. Do we have a quote from him? Should we stand, maybe put our hands over our heart before we read his quote? What an inspiration. He says, I saw thousands of barrels and tires, trucks, tops of school buses and car parts. I just got sick of seeing it all, and I just wanted to do something about it, said that hero.
That's great.
It's just fantastic.
No, seriously. But
it's just incredible. This man's an inspiration to me. He's probably the most heroic man of the entire year. Has anyone done anything more heroic over this past year?
No.
Certainly not. He goes around the country with a fleet of boats, and they try to make cleanup fun for the volunteers. I would point out to CNN that the generally accepted notion of heroism is not fun. Heroism is not fun. So if you're having fun cleaning up the trash, hey, I'm not going to slam you. I might even send a donation because I don't like dirty rivers either. But I would hardly crown you the hero of the year. So it reminds me of a sign I saw. I was driving along a freeway in Seattle, and I saw a sign that said, "Be a hero! Carpool."
Okay.
And I thought, is that all it takes in Seattle? Carpool? I'm a hero? Wow. Anyway, I don't know that we understand heroism. But I think as I read Bob Fu's book, I'll tell you what, this guy strikes me as a hero. And so far in the book that I'm reading, he has had no fun. None. He has had no fun. And I'm sure it just gets worse. I would nominate Bob Fu as hero of the year, frankly. But no, CNN finds a garbage man. He's the hero. He's our hero. All right. Finally, speaking of heroes, let's go to Congressman Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin, great white hope, and savior of the Republican Party and possibly the nation through his fiscal conservatism. House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan said last week that the country doesn't need to worry about another government shutdown. Yep. He says, we will keep the government funded at the current level if need be. There you go, folks. Now that's a hero. He's the man who had the plan to avoid the fiscal catastrophe that surely we're all in for. And he says, well, if we have to keep the government funded at the current level, we're going to do that. He also says he does not believe there will be any brinksmanship over the debt ceiling in February. And finally, he says, let's face it, Obamacare is an entitlement. It's, you know, what can we do? He also argued that closing tax loopholes now would hurt bipartisan attempts to reform the tax code. Deficit reduction from such changes should be used to lower rates, he argued. At which point I said, what is this guy talking about? No, really, this is the kind of inspirational leadership that the Republican Party needs. Yes, I agree. We need to reform the tax code, and such changes should be used to lower tax rates. Now, that's something I can get behind. I'll die on that hill. You charge in, Mr. Ryan. I'm right behind you. So the fiscal conservatives have surrendered. Why? Because there is no underpinning for fiscal conservatism. It's basically just greed. Yeah, they're cheap liberals. They want to steal the money. They want to keep the welfare state growing. But they just want to steal a little less. Let's not make it ridiculous here. Hey, we're in the business of destroying lives, but we can do it with less money. It's ironic that Paul Ryan makes his historic comments here with his inspirational leadership on issues like tax loopholes, lower rates, deficit reduction. At which point the Fox girls hiked up their skirts even higher, and they cheered. I think it's ironic that Ryan makes this inspirational speech during the anniversary of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. The irony of that was not lost on me, Mr. Ryan. It's a different world that we live in now when it comes to the Republican Party than it was during the time of Lincoln. We'll just leave it at that. All right, now, finally, we are going to talk about families. We go to the family file. Older Americans, according to the Wall Street Journal, can be a burden on the economy. I read that and I said, what are you talking about? Older Americans built the economy. There wouldn't be an economy if it wasn't for older Americans. What do you mean they can be a burden? What is wrong with you people? They say that for cash-strapped families, older Americans can actually be a lifeline. Wow, it turns out that older Americans actually have money, and they can help their kids. This is a story. They've got a sociology professor from UCLA who analyzed census data from the 2012 census. And basically, about 25% of adult Americans receive some financial help from their parents. And the Wall Street Journal reports older people are quietly serving as an emergency support system for adult children. Hey, Wall Street Journal, that's called family. Yeah, it's not an emergency support system. It's called family. That's all. That's a foreign concept to someone at UCLA. If the government's not writing a check, surely people are dying in the streets. And they find this study that says, wait a minute, families are actually helping each other. Shazam! Ay, ay, ay. So this professor says, the older generation today helps the younger generation by giving them scarce resources of time and money. Such intergenerational transfers were common during the Great Depression, and they may be on the increase in the U.S. What do you mean it was common during the Great Depression? It was just common. It's called family, you communists. Unbelievable. Anyway, they conclude by saying supporting adult children can mean physical, emotional, and financial strains for mom and dad. Well, no kidding. Love is not always just a warm, fuzzy feeling. Sometimes it's a lot of work, it's risky, and it's uncomfortable. That's love. Yeah, this professor at sociology professor at UCLA has no concept of love, no concept of family, just operating in a worldview that is devoid of anything spiritual, of anything true, of anything related to his creator, her creator. Just pathetic. Well, we're out of time. That's it, folks. I've got to go. I'll be on the radio with Bob this week on Denver Radio, so be sure to tune in to KLTT at 3 o'clock every day just to find out if I'm there. Should the Lord tarry, I'll return next week. I want to thank my friends at KGOV, Denver Bible Church, and American Right to Life. And, of course, my other brother, Darrell, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios, and my extremely attractive audio engineer. As I said, should the Lord tarry, I'll return next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.